This is Andrew Ngvari, aka Drew Unga, and you're listening to Stephen LeBron Radio.
Stephen LeBron Radio.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Y'all yeah, been fretting. Without an ounce of thugging, you go against me, you two can count for nothing. King of the backpackers, it's T-Bone contact any whack rapper. It's biometric, I wet you, my dialect, an entire weapon, a set you just fire records. Black, like,
one, two,
guns true, in the same booth, the federales trying to run through. Like,
three, four,
we raw, me and Vish trading like a triple beam seesaw. I'm a veteran, the Mac 11, the pump, you can name whoever you want, name. Yay, yay. You take me serious, then I might trip. About
7-8
niggas and die, feeling some type of way. I figure it's pride. I'm the right on truth, and that's right. I'm either plotting on my own truth. Joke, crooked, or tears. Slow
down. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Y'all been front.
Uh-huh.
Without an ounce of thugging, you go against me. You two can count for nothing. Like,
All right, everyone, this is episode 24 of the podcast. As always, easiest way to catch up with the podcast is to look for it in the iTunes store, looking up Stephen LeBron Radio. You can follow me on Twitter at Stephen underscore LeBron, and all the podcast episodes are also posted on my blog, which I write at StephenLeBron.com. So today I have a return guest. It's Drew Unga, which many of you are familiar with. He's a frequent guest host on Jensen Karp's Get Up on This podcast. He writes at Lakers Nation, and he's what I call one of the most reasonable Lakers fans on, maybe not even just on the internet, maybe just in general. So you can follow him on Twitter at Drew Unga, DREWUNGA. I suggest you do so. Interesting, lots of interesting info, interesting links, all that stuff. Hey, how's it going, Unga?
I'm good. I'm happy to do this again. It's fun. We did it twice last time.
Last time, I don't know if anyone knew, but we recorded it once. I think the sound quality was shitty. And then you were nice enough to just do the whole thing again. We had the same conversation twice.
Yeah, and then what happened was when we did it the second time, because the sound was so bad, I didn't want to move. But it started when the sun was still out in L.A., and then it finished when the sun was down. And my wife came home, and she saw me sitting on the floor with my laptop on my lap in the dark. And she was like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, I remember, didn't you have to like move chairs and beds and everything? I remember you were moving a lot of stuff.
I took her little makeup bench that she sits on when she does her makeup, and I put my computer on top of that, and then I sat kind of underneath it with my legs because I sat close to the router, just, you know, in case that was the reason why the sound was bad, and I had the windows closed, and then so I didn't want to just stay close to the router, and I didn't want to move much, so I figured, you know, least likely that I would have to move if I was close enough to the router in case it were, and I just changed the internet carriers, providers. Don't go with Time Warner if you're listening at home and it's an option. It's horrible.
Say no to Time Warner.
Say no to Time Warner on everything, but especially internet. I mean, they gave me such a good deal that I was like, hey, you know, it's just a year. But like, there's like pockets in my house where it doesn't work.
You know, the other reason I had you on, I actually had requests because people liked the first episode with you.
Oh, cool, man.
Yeah. I don't make it sound like, you know, a million people listen to this, but, you know, three or four people mentioned it, so.
Well, Jensen had a different guy guest us a couple weeks ago, Lewis Peitzman, who writes for BuzzFeed. And Jensen had asked me earlier if I could do it, and I think it was the day of the Final Four, and I told him I couldn't do it, so he had no choice but to find somebody else. So he found Lewis, you know, who's a really bright guy. He's also good on Twitter. And somebody sent me a message on Twitter a couple days after it debuted and was like, he sent it to me, and Jensen was like, please, never anyone else again.
Wow.
Like, yeah, I don't know. I haven't listened to the one with Lewis yet. The guy kind of scared me from wanting to listen to it. I will. I still have it. But it's cool to get people that are like, when are you going to be on again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get a little buzz.
I thought Jensen was punishing me because he's a big Clipper fan, and I talked a lot of shit about the Clippers losing.
How's he taking it?
You know, I haven't had an in-depth conversation with him just yet. I kind of wanted to give him a little bit of space. I expected that what happened to the Lakers happening. I don't think Clipper fans were prepared for, even though they should be by now, Clipper fans should be able to, should be prepared for anything other than success.
Well, I think by all accounts, it's a good season on Clippers by the definition of the Clippers. They had a 17-game win streak. They won the division.
Right? They swept the Lakers.
The series on the in the first round really turned on a dime. I mean, you'd expect a 2-0 lead. They could at least take it to a game seven after going up 2-0. But, hey, still a good season for the Clippers, I think.
Yeah, a lot of questions, though, going on right now. You'd rather be in the Clippers' shoes and, have had the season they had, and unfortunately it had the bad ending. But, even if you're scared about, what's going to happen with Chris Paul or what's going to happen with Matt Barnes or who's the next coach, that's what being a sports fan is all about. I remember when Kobe was a free agent. I remember when the Celtics were trying to trade Kevin Garnett and the Lakers were a possibility. When you sit there and hit refresh, this was pre-Twitter, in 07 when they were going after Garnett. I remember I went with my wife to a work thing for her in San Diego. And, I had nothing to do other than sit in my room with my computer and hit refresh, hoping that the Lakers were going to get KG. And, to me, that's sports in this era, in the internet era, is, rather than having the headset, in your ear, hoping for that update of finding out you got a guy in a trade, but sitting there with Twitter alerts and Google alerts and hoping, even if it doesn't work out the way you want it to, that drama is nowhere else, it seems, in our lives.
Yeah.
Other than, finding out the sex of our, newborn or whatever, things like that.
Real life stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The stuff that kind of matters as much as sports.
Yeah. I asked you, I think I asked you this in an email, but so tell me a little about a Lakers fan's relationship with the Clippers compared to the Celtics. Because I think I asked you if God forbid there was ever a Clippers-Celtics finals, who you would root for, right?
Yes. Well, and I told you that I had this exact scenario in 2002 when the Angels played the Giants in the World Series. And I mean, the thing is that Dodger fans don't hate Angel fans. And now they do because the Angels call themselves the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. But before that, they're really – and plus so many of the guys that were affiliated with that Angels team, Mike Socha, Mickey Hatcher, Alfredo Griffin, I think Rick Dempsey. So a lot of those guys not only were on the Dodgers, but they were involved in the last World Series team that the Dodgers had in 88. So it was easy to root for that team as much as it was like – rooting for the Ducks or rooting for the Angels as a fan or somebody who lives in LA, it's just something you don't do because we have our own teams and you look like a bandwagon jumper. Mm-hmm. But the fact is they played the Giants and I'll never root for the Giants. I'll never root for the Celtics. So if I have to go with the lesser of two evils, if the Celtics were to play the Clippers, I don't have hatred for the Clippers like I have for the Celtics. The hatred that I have for the Clippers is also rooted in the fact that they now,
it's a little territorial, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel threatened by the Clippers, but I do hate having to explain to people that if the Lakers had an 18-game losing streak at the time the Clippers had a 17-game winning streak, the top story on any sports radio show in LA is what can the Lakers do to halt this 18-game losing streak? The only way the Clippers can ever take attention in any way away from the Lakers would be by winning a championship or, getting close to it in a way that people have no choice but to talk about it. If the Lakers were to hire a coach the day before game one of an NBA Finals game involving the Clippers, sports talk radio will talk about the hiring of that coach. And because, look, callers dictate sports talk radio. So, the fact of the matter is that just tells you the mindset of the city. But, and this is what I told Matt Moore last year, we had a conversation about this, because I was trying to explain to people that you're never, it would take 20 years, possibly for the Clippers to ever, not because they're never going to out-accomplish the Lakers, but they could, at least win over hearts and minds. But the only people that you can go after at this point, if you're trying to, take over a city or to gain a larger piece of the pie, are young people, because young people are less discriminate. So if, you know, somebody like Blake Griffin, you know, is a superhero. If I was a 7-year-old kid right now, Blake Griffin would be my hero, just because of, you know, and I love Chris Paul too. Don't get me wrong. I would love Chris Paul, but, and, you know, I mean, Kobe is Kobe for this, but it would be for the same reasons that people loved Kobe, you know, 14 years ago. The things that Blake Griffin does, if you're a kid, you grab a ball, you go out into the court and you pretend like you can do those things, or you put the hoop on your, you know, the back of your door. Yeah. And your styrofoam ball. And so, you know, like, if, and then you would need that entire generation of kids to grow up as Clipper fans and then never, you know, ever turn and become Laker fans. So, you know, I don't have hatred for the Clippers or their fans. It's just sort of like, don't try to, like,
I feel like you don't take them seriously.
That's it. That's exactly
like you don't take them seriously enough for it to matter, for it to actually bother you.
So when they do try to talk shit, and here's my other thing about Clipper fans, like, for the most part, most of us get to choose, if you live in Los Angeles, which team you're going to be a fan of.
Yeah.
So why would anybody choose to be a fan of that team? Just because of their owner. Forget about, I mean, yeah, they're losing ways. Yeah, that would also, but that, look, if you want to root for a team that, I'm a Raider fan, but if you want to root for a team that, you know, loses every year, that's your prerogative, but then you take into account that this is an owner who routinely let his best players walk away, who routinely traded them for pennies on the dollar because he didn't want to re-sign them, who, you know, in his own personal life, you know, the laundry list of things is so high that how can anybody root for that guy to hold up a championship trophy? So, you know, in that respect, it's sort of like, I can understand somebody moving here from Boston and saying, there's no way I'm going to be a Laker fan, but I want my kids to have a team. At least that's what the Clippers are here for. You know, I'm friends with Brian Greenberg, the actor, and he's, you know, he lives in LA and in New York. He's from St. Louis. So as a kid, you know, I guess he was, you know, a Kings fan because that was the last team in Missouri. But he could never root for the Lakers because of that. So he's adopted the Knicks, but, like, he came out here, and when he was a fan of a team out here, it was the Clippers. He just, you know, like, I can't see anybody moving out here and becoming a Laker fan. I know one person that has.
See, I always thought it'd be a good idea to sell inside-out jerseys. One side is the Clippers and one side's the Lakers, just to let people flip.
Do you remember when the Nets did that? Well, I mean, it wasn't like they did Nets and Knicks, but, you know, nobody was buying tickets to Nets games, so they were selling jerseys that had there were New Jersey Nets jerseys on one side, and then it was like a Chris Paul Hornets jersey on the other side.
This actually happened?
Yeah, no, you could find it. Yeah, there's definitely, if you Google it, you can just do like New Jersey Nets reversible jerseys giveaways or something. And so they sold like a package. It was like a 10-game package, and each game came with a reversible jersey that had a New Jersey Net on one side and the best player on another team, whoever, like, they might have been playing that night, on the other side of the jersey.
That's hilarious. It sucks that my idea is taken.
Well, but the thing is that theirs was not only a giveaway, which made it even, but also it didn't involve, like, the Knicks. So, you know, your idea. But, like, I don't know anybody that was, you know, it's easy for people to talk about LA and bandwagon fans. And I think there are casual fans who care more about the Lakers during the playoffs, obviously, than they do during the regular season. But I don't think that those same people become Clipper fans.
Right.
You know, there are Laker fans and there are casual Laker fans.
I've never gotten the impression, really. I think, obviously, the general impression, because it's LA, because the crowd sometimes show up late and there's celebs there, that I think there's this stigma about bandwagon. But just from being online and everything, I feel like Lakers fans are the most passionate and diehards. I don't find Lakers fans to be, like, insufferable, as many people do.
You know, I was proud of how many people, at least on Twitter, during Game 4, watched the game, you know, tweeted about the game, were involved in the discussion, because I frankly didn't think anybody but, like, Darius Soriano and I were going to be watching this game. Mm-hmm. And people that, like, had to, because of they write for certain blogs. So for me, you know, it was cool to see that. And I wasn't going to draw attention to it at that point and be like, you know, you don't really give shout outs to people who show up to watch a playoff game.
Shout out for watching them get swept.
Yeah, but it was sort of like, you know, like, for all the people who think that there are so many bandwagon fans, the presence on Twitter during a inevitable series sweep was pretty, you know, I was impressed by.
I think people just have a distaste for the franchise, and then it just trickles down just because of their success and everything, that it trickles down to the fans.
Yeah, I mean, like, I wasn't even going to try to defend, you know, like, I was going to try to defend the franchise to all the people who treated it. Like, I remember I told you in the email that it was almost as if there was this, like, universal oath amongst everybody else to, let's pretend that the Spurs swept a Laker team at full strength that won 55 games. When in reality, this was a team that won 45 games, was missing six of its top nine players, but it's no fun to talk shit about, you know, the handicapped kid. So instead, we'll just pretend like he's got, you know, full functionality, and we'll make fun of that guy.
That's a crazy analogy, but go on.
Well, it was the only thing I could think of right now, so I apologize to anybody who was offended by that, but it was the first thing I could think of. But,
I love how you apologize. I'm going to send them some of your tweets, but go on.
But what I did write was, and this was the God's honest truth, because I felt like, because Bomani Jones did this thing all season long where it was sort of like, his thing was, this is who you are now, talking about Laker fans. Like nobody was, I wasn't bragging about the fact that they made the playoffs so much as calling out all the people who said that there was no way they were going to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
So I think that, so and I had to come up with something that I was going to tweet that he couldn't take that and write, this is who you are now. Mm-hmm. So what I wrote was that, the fact of the matter is this team finished with the 11th best record in the NBA, and it was dubbed a nightmare season. And it was dubbed the nightmare season because not only did they, you know, start out 17-25 and various people got injured, including Kobe, but the owner also died. So, you know, take away the death of the owner and all of the injuries. If this team winning 45 games and finishing with the 11th best record in the league quantifies as a season from hell, I wrote, I hope that, let that always be the standard for this franchise. Let 45 wins always be considered a failure.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. The 45 ties the franchise high that the Raptors have.
You're kidding.
In like 19 years. Yeah, it's really? Either 45 or 47. I might be off. It's 47 at best.
And if they were in the East, the Lakers, they probably would have won 52.
Yeah, you know, you opened my eyes when you told me, I completely forgot that they finished the season 28-12. I know that they made a run obviously at the end there to get to the eighth spot, but 28-12 is not too shabby to close.
No, the worst thing that happened to them was that they weren't able to take advantage of the easy part of their schedule in the beginning, because they had a very easy home friendly schedule in the beginning of the season that they completely whiffed on because of the injuries and because they couldn't figure out how to get things to work, and they had three coaches in a week. And so that was probably what forced them to play catch up, because when they fell to 17-25, if you look at the four or five games that they played that they lost in a row, I'll pull it up while I'm talking to you, it was like the toughest road trip ever. And then you combine the fact that they were missing so many guys and starting Robert Sacre at center, you know, during that particular stretch, that really set them back too. Like, there's nothing worse than looking at your team's schedule and going, loss, but before these games are played, and going, that's a loss, because, you know, I'm not used to that, but it's like, I'm a pretty realistic person when it comes to, like, you know, who I think they can beat and who I can't, depending on how good they are. Mm-hmm. Here, this was the stretch of games when they fell to 17-25. They lost to Miami, then they lost at Toronto. That was the game where, you know, Dwight Howard got ejected. Then at Chicago, at Memphis. So those were the four that they lost in a row to drop to 17-25. And then before those four, they won two against Cleveland and Milwaukee. But then before that, they lost six in a row to the first one to Philadelphia at home, which was embarrassing. They shouldn't, you know, that was the end. But then they lost to the Clippers, the Nuggets, the Rockets, the Spurs, and the Thunder. So there they had a stretch where they lost 10 of 12 games, only one of which, I'm not even going to call that Toronto game embarrassing, because it wasn't. I mean, they played embarrassing, but that's always a tough place to play on a Sunday morning.
It is. It's a schedule break for us.
Yeah, and it's even when the Lakers were winning championships, when Turkoglu was knocking down free throws, you know, to beat them. Even when the Lakers were good, they were having trouble winning that game in Toronto on a Sunday morning. So yeah. I'm not even going to call that one embarrassing. But yeah, none of those other losses are embarrassing. So, you know, and unfortunately, you know, when, you know, that early part of the schedule when they lost to, you know, Cleveland, Orlando at home. They choked a game away to Houston. They choked two games at Houston away where they had huge leads. They lost to Sacramento and Indiana, that 79-77 game. Mm-hmm. That was probably the ugliest game of the year. So, yeah. So, you know, that's what – it just – that you know, they weren't able to take advantage and pad their win total so that by the end of the season they could, you know, win between 50 and 55. But look, there was no time during the season that I look at this team and I was like, yeah, now they're playing the way we thought they were.
Yeah. You know?
So this was a season where a lot of the wins felt like losses.
What do you think about Mike D'Antoni? It seems like no one's really too positive about him, right?
You know, I'm one of those people who doesn't dwell too long on things that I have no control over. I'm more like, he's our coach. Let's just figure out, like, you know, where to go from here. Because if I sit there and I complain about how the coach needs to get fired, my voice means zero. The voice of the fans collectively, especially with this franchise where they fired a coach because he started the season 1-3 or 1-4. So, like, believe me, if D'Antoni's really that bad next season, you know, and they're going into an offseason that's the biggest in the franchise's, you know, since 1996, believe me, they'll have the coaching change. But I feel like, look, he's their coach. He came into a situation where he was, like, doped up on painkillers coming off a knee surgery.
Oh, yeah, he couldn't even walk.
Yeah, you know, the team was like 5-4 or 4-4, no training camp, numerous injuries, definitely not the type of personnel for his style of play, and that's not on him. That's much on ownership who picked him to be their next coach. So let's see what happens, you know, with what they give him in a training camp. And I'm not saying he's a great coach, but I'm saying he's probably a better coach than most people in LA think he is.
Yeah, and you're saying that if he is not the right coach, the Lakers will recognize that and they'll make the move.
Yeah, and I ask people, I mean, like, here's the thing. There's three groups of people in L.A., or there's one group of people who seem to all have the same opinion when it comes to three things. And I used to say it was two things, but they added a third thing, and that's all the people, the Bernie Bickerstaff crowd. Like, there are all these people who thought Bernie Bickerstaff should have got the job because the team went 3-1 as interim coach. Oh, no, I'm sorry, 4-1, and all five games were at home. And, you know, two of them, look, you know, one was against Houston and one of them was against Golden State. But the one game he lost was to San Antonio. It wasn't like they were like, you know, and so like, and then there's the people who like love Byron Scott and wanted Byron Scott to get the job.
Really?
And,
I did not know that.
Yeah. And then those are the same people who love Brandon Jennings. Like, there's this whole group of LA people who think Brandon Jennings is the answer. So, you know, it's like, I can't tweet at every one of these people and be like, one, you're wrong, two, you're embarrassing us. Please stop with the Brandon Jennings.
Is the Brandon Jennings thing just because he's from that area? Like, he's from—
I think what it is that people hear about a guy as a free agent, whether he's a restricted free agent or not, and they just figure, like, he's from LA, so he's the answer, and we can get him because Milwaukee can't afford him. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, you know, I haven't written anything for Lakers Nation in a while, but I was telling you because I was doing a project for the last 3 months. But, like, I think the first thing that I want to write is just going to be this, you know, stop, you're embarrassing us. These are the things that you need to know before you start a conversation. And to see people like Stephen A. Smith who make these same errors, like Stephen A. Smith thinks that the Lakers can sign Chris Paul
you're not allowed.
Bill Plaschke did the same thing. Yeah, where, like, you don't understand, like, you're over the cap. That doesn't mean that, you know, that you can still sign guys because you're willing to pay the luxury tax. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, and I can't take each of these people and be like, explain to them the rules of the collective bargaining agreement. So I might as well just write one post that says, you know, here, these are things that people tend to think are true that aren't.
Yeah.
And the new one that used to be true but no longer is about sign and trades. A lot of people don't know that. The rules for sign and trades change with this collective bargaining agreement. Mm-hmm. It used to be that you could sign a player to the max that he could make on the team that had his bird rights, and then they could then trade him. That's what happened with, you know, a lot of guys who were signed and traded. Not with LeBron because he took a pay cut, but he could have. So what happened with the newest CBA is that teams, I guess some of the small market teams figured, why if these guys are going to try to use us to be signed and traded. Let's penalize them, and by penalizing them, meaning that players, the maximum amount of money that a player can get in a sign and trade is now the exact same max that he can get from a team as a free agent. So there is no incentive now for Dwight Howard to ask Lakers for a sign and trade because Atlanta can offer him the same amount of money that he would get in a sign and trade. The only difference is that he'd be weakening Atlanta, mm-hmm, by accepting a sign and trade if the Lakers require draft picks or, you know, some type of player compensation, that Dwight felt like, I don't have to do a sign and trade. So why am I doing that if I'm going to lose Josh Smith as you know, as my teammate?
Or yeah, so the only way he's getting that extra $20 or $30 million is with the Lakers.
Exactly.
Regardless of any method.
And this is what I tell everybody, and this is what they, you know, it seems like a jerk move for a Vince Carter or Chris Webber to want out of a team after they sign the max. But if you're that player, it would make much more sense to go, you know what, I'm going to sign this contract for $30 million more. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not happy in a year, I'm going to ask the team to trade me. And, you know, they don't have to, but why would they want a disgruntled, unhappy player on their team? And at least I know when I get traded, I'm going to take that contract with me.
Yeah.
So it's in Dwight Howard's best interest, you know, to accept that money regardless. Just like I tell Laker fans who don't want them to re-sign Dwight Howard, that this team has no assets. So even if you don't want him re-signed, you're better off having them sign him. And if it doesn't work out, then you can trade him for other assets. But for a team that has two draft picks between now and, you know, 2019, yeah, two first round picks, you know, oh, and even though they have a ton of cap space next year, like you're talking about a team that's got most of its guys in their mid 30s. So, you know, if you ideally thought about best case scenario on every one of these players and what you could get in a trade for them, it's not much money. So when you think, except for Dwight, you know, if Dwight were on the open, not open market, but if Dwight were on the trading block, you know, this is a guy that could net, you know, 2 to 3 first round picks,
yeah,
you know, so they have no choice given the fact that they have so few assets.
I think it's such a knee jerk reaction for a lot of the fans to think that they don't want Dwight Howard back. Obviously, tough season for the team, tough season for him, even though he played a lot better, I think, in the second half. But then people are going to remember how the playoffs ended. I mean, you're comparing the Dwight Howard of this season to the Dwight Howard of the past, but if you compare Dwight Howard just as an NBA player to everyone else, that's still such an asset, like you mentioned.
Sure. I mean, you know, look, if Dwight Howard decided to become Tyson Chandler, right, mm-hmm, a guy with really no offensive skill set other than dunking a ball, and he just focused on blocking shots, you know, playing volleyball, knocking offensive rebounds to teammates, and setting high screens, you know, then you would view Dwight in a completely different light. But Dwight, he wants to be considered the best center in the world, so he has to prove it on both ends of the court. And the thing is that Lakers fans took Andrew Bynum for granted in terms of his skill set. I mean, Andrew Bynum had a variety of post moves.
Yeah.
And when he was healthy, he was, you know, and he was at his footwork had just, you know, just gotten so amazing. Honestly, I mean, this is a side note. Thank God he didn't play this season. And I wish him nothing but the best, because if he was there on top of all the stuff that he went through, and yeah, Laker fans had to see like Bynum averaging like 26 and 12, or, you know, or like 22 and 10, whatever,
yeah,
there would have been so much anger for trading him away. And there'd have been so many people pretending that they said, I told you we shouldn't have traded him, you know, and so we didn't have to like deal with all that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, look, what scares me about Dwight is giving a guy a 5-year deal who relies on his athleticism, which was taken away from him this year. And I believe it'll come back. But I think that, you know, I don't think that Dwight's going to be great in the fifth year of a 5-year deal, because I just feel like as he gets older, unless he can really develop some better moves, post moves on offense, you know, he's just going to become, you know, 60% of who he is now. And this season he was 60% of who he was a year ago. And yet he still averaged, what, 17 and 12 and finished second in the league in rebound.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Because people want him to basically be like a, like you mentioned, like a Bynum, or even obviously the name that gets mentioned is like a Shaq. But on this team, depending on who they surround him with, I think you're onto something in that they just need him to be a Tyson Chandler. That's the stuff that they need him to do, right? I'm not sure with the right cast that they necessarily need him to be a scorer as much as just a low post threat.
The thing is that even if they wanted him to just be, you know, Joakim Noah or Tyson Chandler, they can't tell him that until he signs that piece of paper that says yes. Because the thing is that, you know, even though the organization was very good with how they dealt with him all season long. I mean, you know, Magic Johnson, you know, people forget, he's no longer involved with the organization. So you can't take anything Magic said seriously. But as far as everything that Mitch Kupchak said in terms of, you know, defending him, whether it came to the All-Star game or talking about where he felt, you know, or that always said that we believe this is still the best place for him to be, you know, all of those things, I think that he knows that, you know, the organization loves him, they want him back, that they've gotten moves planned for next year. And but I, you know, it was the fans who really ran out of patience, and he became the, you know, the punching bag and for this season. And it was unfortunate because he played with a surgically repaired back and then later a torn labrum. And a lot of that was his fault, the torn labrum, just because. But that was a result of the back injury. I mean, he lost a lot of his explosiveness. And what was happening was he was giving teams more time to foul him. And that's why in getting hacked is how he tore his shoulder. So I don't think at 27 years old you can lose your explosiveness forever or forget how to play. I just felt like for a guy who relied so much on athleticism and you take that away from him, I'm not surprised by what we saw from him this year. But when we did see the explosiveness there, especially on defense, I mean, yeah, towards the end of the season, he had some, you know, huge blocks, or he just, you realize, you know, they're reminders of how good he was. And I don't think a lot of Laker fans saw much of him in his career to, you know, think to like to get an idea of or remember, you know, how good he was. So I think that he'll return to being that type of player. I just don't know for how long he'll be that good.
Yeah. We've talked about the Lakers for 20 minutes and barely even mentioned Kobe. What's up with that?
Yeah. You know, it's I don't know if I was in denial or if it was something that like I expected or, you know, like at the same time, you know, I have no qualms at all that Kobe's not only going to come back, but he'll be just as fine and good as he was this year. And I don't know, you know, maybe for just one more year in his career, mm-hmm. but I don't think anybody who's that dedicated to, you know, training and rehab and whatever it takes. I hope that he doesn't rush back, just yeah. like, you know, Derrick Rose not rushing back. I what Simmons wrote last week, I saw about Gilbert Arenas, and I completely forgot about that, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, Gilbert Arenas rushing back from an injury, you know, and hurting himself again and then again. And with Kobe, you know, one more injury like this and you're done. And there's a high percentage. I think it's like over 50% of people who tear one Achilles end up tearing the other one mm-hmm. because you end up favoring one foot over the other.
Yeah.
But Kobe's changed his game so much anyway recently. He's really, you know, I mean, he's not really, even though he had some amazing dunks this year, that's not really his game, and I don't think we'll see many of those left. You know, but yeah, he will be the you know, mid-range, fall-away guy. But, you know, like, I have mixed feelings about Kobe this year. As amazing as he was at times, I felt like because they dug themselves such a deep hole that Kobe took it upon himself to do whatever he could do to help them win games, as ugly as they were. And they weren't the kind of games they were winning in which the team was making strides. Mm-hmm. You know, so I felt like what he was doing was good enough to win and get them in the playoffs, but it wasn't great for the long term. And, you know, what they ended up doing was making Kobe the primary ball handler and turning Steve Nash into Steve Kerr, because it wasn't a team that had a lot of great shooters. And in order to open things up for their bigs, they needed to take the ball out of Nash's hand and spot him up for three-point shots. And I don't think that maximized Nash's abilities. And I don't think I felt Kobe, you know, did just way too much in terms of taking a team with 40% new starters and trying to, you know, gel into becoming a contender. So yeah. What I saw was a team that had enough to win games and make the playoffs. But I never saw the strides that they needed to make in order to become a contender. Yeah. So I'm proud of the season he had. But at the same time, I felt like had they not dug themselves into a hole, we might've been able to see this real team. And that's why, you know, I'm not saying that they're by any means a contender next year, but I would like to see what they could do with the same team in another year, just to get an idea of whether or not it could work.
Yeah, I think the most disappointing, and it's not his fault, it's just a lot of injuries and circumstances. The most disappointing player was Steve Nash, just because never got to see him run the team, never really got to see him and Pau together on the court, because Pau was hurt for a little bit. And then, like you mentioned, when Nash came back with Kobe became the ball handler for much of the time. And, you know, it just seemed like Nash never really found that fit on the team And then obviously injuries to start and end the season kind of just wrecked the rest of that.
Yeah, and well, and my big thing was is that D'Antoni was only using them together, Kobe and Nash, and that we never got a chance to see Nash with Dwight alone, and we never really got a chance to see, you know, Nash with Powell alone. And, you know, for some reason, he just felt like these guys had to be on and off the court at the exact same time. So I was thinking that when Kobe got injured that we might see that from Nash, and then Nash never came back from the injury before the season ended. And then I think D'Antoni made a huge mistake by inserting Nash into the starting lineup for the playoffs, because those last few games without Kobe were the best that Powell and Dwight had played together all season long with Steve Blake. And I thought, you know what, this team might be able to beat a banged-up Spurs team, because we didn't know how healthy Tony Parker was going to be or Manu Ginobili was going to be. And we knew Dia was going to miss the series. So, you know, look, I don't hope injury on anybody. But at the same time, I was thinking, well, this team could potentially – and they had just beat San Antonio in a game in which Parker was awful, even, and Powell was also. And I think that you insert Nash back into the lineup after these guys were playing well together, and it was sort of like nobody really knew where they were supposed to be. I think he started Nash and Blake together in game one, so there was some weirdness there too with those guys sharing the backcourt. And I think D'Antoni and he did it again in game two. And the fact of the matter was Nash was hurt, so it wasn't like you were starting 100% healthy Nash. He could have helped the team a lot more coming off the bench, I felt, than immediately putting him into the starting lineup and hoping that they can make it work as good as they did without him at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. Is there any chance Phil Jackson will be back with the organization at some point?
Not this year, I don't think. But, you know, and the thing about Phil is he's engaged to Jeannie, which means at some point he'll be part owner of this team. I mean, and I'm not saying that he would want, when they're married, I guess he could stake claim to being part owner of this team. I'm not saying he would want to have his fingers on that document that would say that, or, you know, that he would need it, or, you know, or it would be something that would be a completely separate entity that he wouldn't be involved with. But I felt like the Lakers made a decision for the long term when they hired D'Antoni, which was the Clippers have a athletic team that's fun to watch and photogenic, and we have a team that's aging, we need to sell our franchise player on the future, and we want it to be entertaining. And if we hire Phil Jackson, we know we've got him for 2 years, and then what are we going to do? Whereas I think they looked at D'Antoni as, you know, Showtime, the sequel, and they felt like this team's going to change a lot after next season, so why not bring a coach in who has a style that's more appealing, that can compete better for entertainment dollars with the Clippers? And if they made a mistake, we'll find out soon enough. But I don't know. I think with Phil, I think the fact that Phil was wavering and said to them, why don't we talk again on Sunday? I think they never felt in their conversation, and this is just me speculating, I don't want anybody to think that I'm, you know, reporting something that I know, but knowing that what Phil had said about, you know, we had agreed to talk again on Sunday, I don't think that was the Lakers doing. I think that was Phil saying, yeah, well, let me think about it. Talk to me on Sunday. And I felt like if he really wanted to come back, he would have made it abundantly clear, and they wouldn't have continued conversations with other candidates. And I think that, you know, once they knew that D'Antoni was there, it was sort of like, well, we know he's there now. We don't know if he'll be there in 2 years when Phil retires again.
Yeah, because now he's I read that he's advising for the with Detroit with their coaching search.
Well, yeah, there was that. He was offered that position, and I compared it to when the Wizards hired Michael Jordan. I think the Wizards hired Michael Jordan to be their GM because they felt if he ever decided to play basketball again, it would be for the Wizards. And I felt like Detroit thought, all right, well, if we give Phil this job as a consultant or advisor, if he ever decides to coach again, it'll be with the Pistons. And, you know, they have a new owner, Tom Gores, who, you know, wants to make a splash. And they have a little bit of cap space since they made that trade. Your point guard, Calderon.
Calderon.
Yeah, the Tayshaun Prince Calderon. So, and now they're in a position, do they bring back Calderon? And if they don't bring back Calderon, does Powell give him a call? If Powell doesn't get traded and say, look, you know what? There's not a lot of starting point guard jobs in this league. But you could probably, you know, like something would maybe with him and Nash where they would split minutes regardless of who the starter is. And you know, maybe he comes here on the cheap because he's made a lot of money in his career and he's a little bit older. And who knows what kind of offers he's going to get. And the point guard position has never been deeper than it is right now in the NBA, and you've got a few more studs in this year's draft. So, you know, and it just kills me that, you know, like Lakers end up with the Derek Fisher and Steve Nash and Raymond Sessions while every other team has a better point guard. And then I had the friend of mine texting me during the Oklahoma City game going, "You watching Fisher? He's better than Nash." I was like, "Yeah, ask Oklahoma City if they trade him Fisher for a healthy Nash."
Yeah. So can you put to rest all these rumors that are saying that Phil Jackson will actually come to Toronto?
I just feel like Phil doesn't want to be that far from Jeannie. I think that if Phil was, you know, single, I think he would consider, you know, I don't know if he would consider coaching, but he might consider some type of, you know, GM or vice president job with Toronto. Yeah. But, you know, I do believe that Phil looks at Miami and thinks that he could do what Riley's doing. You know, I don't know if he'd be as good at it as Riley. I mean, if you think about, I mean, you know, the Lakers drafted Patrick Beverley. But they've probably drafted Patrick Beverley for Miami, so because he was traded within hours of the Lakers drafting him, and Miami had paid almost $2 million for that draft pick. And then Miami sent Patrick Beverley overseas for a year. I think they had him in training camp before they eventually let him go. And then, you know, Houston signed him to their D-League team. But I don't think Phil Jackson has the ability to do what it – not the ability, but maybe the patience to do what it would take to find – Patrick Beverley, buy a second round draft pick from another team to draft that guy, send him overseas for a year, knowing that you don't have that you need maximum cap space in 2010 to sign LeBron James, and then you have him at your disposal to bring back. So when I, you know, Riley has, you know, developed that over 20 years, can Phil in his 60s, you know, learn what it takes to be that kind of, you know, talent evaluator, or to learn, you know, like Riley did something with James Jones, even though James Jones doesn't play anymore, he did something with James Jones that was like crazy in a sense that he signed James Jones to a 1-year contract that had like a buyout, and the buyout was like $5 million that could be paid over 3 years. So after the first year, he waived him. So now he was responsible for the buyout, but the buyout didn't count against the cap. So he then signed James Jones to an NBA minimum deal. So James Jones was pretty much collecting two checks for Miami. One was the NBA veterans minimum deal, and the other one was the buyout money for him being waived. So it was pretty much double dipping, but it was completely legal.
He rigged the system.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, if you're not cheating, you know, you're not trying. But it was just one of those things where it was like, wow, man, how come nobody else has ever thought of that? And I think what Riley did was he said, here's James Jones from Miami, who probably wants to come and play at home. And I, you know, even though him doing that might have been illegal, saying to him, I'm going to waive you after the first year, he might not have said that to him. But at least with James Jones, it was sort of like, you're going to guarantee get this $1 million or, you know, or $2 million. And then next year, if we do cut you, we owe you X amount of dollars. And it stipulates in your contract that we owe you that money this year, and this year. So he was able to pay James Jones more than double the NBA veterans minimum because, you know, he had the foresight to figure that out while still maintaining the cap space, or even signing what's his name? There's Canadian center, Joel Anthony, 5 years, $17 million contract that people thought was absurd. Well, you know, 5 years, $17 million for your starting center or even a backup center who's pretty good defensively, not bad, you know? So I don't know if Phil has that gene.
Yeah,
but, you know, but I think the same thing with Toronto, like I was talking about with Detroit and with Michael Jordan. I think that Detroit would look at it. I mean, Toronto would look at it like if Phil Jackson decides to coach. But, you know, and the, you have to quantify that by saying if you were the head coach of that team or that team is looking for a head coach, who wants that job? It's, you know.
Yeah,
who,
well, that's what I was going to say, because, you know, obviously Riley was breathing down Stan Van Gundy's neck and then took his job. And then even Eric Spoelstra, before he won the title last year, you know, Riley was such a huge shadow, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Riley was smart about, you know, he didn't do interviews for like a year. I think, you know, because he didn't want to have to deal with those types of questions about Spoelstra. And I think that, you know, with Phil, I think Phil likes the sound of his own voice.
But what about like a Phil Jackson-Brian Shaw combination, right?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't think Phil would stab Brian Shaw in the back. But, you know, I think that Brian Shaw will get a shot like I could see Phil, you know, in an advisory role where he sits in on practices and helps to teach the triangle offense, and then, you know, he's nowhere to be seen during games. I can see Phil doing that type of thing. But I think, you know, when you look at Toronto, you have to look at the roster and who signed and for how many years and say to yourself, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, and the thing is that they did, they made strides this year, and nobody can deny that. I mean, you know, the Gay trade, you know, we'll see, and it's, you know, only a couple of years left on that. But in terms of DeRozan making strides,
I don't think we made any strides, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, in terms of player development, like the franchise itself, and as a team, maybe they didn't take those necessary steps, but guys who they bet on, like DeRozan, and even taking the most underrated first round pick of the draft this year.
No, Terrence Ross?
Yeah. I mean, so he turned out to be, you know, a good pick. It, you know, it sucks when you have a lottery pick and like Ed Davis, and he becomes a throw-in in a trade that you probably could have held on to. Mm-hmm. And when he starts to kind of turn things around. And Amir Johnson didn't have a horrible season.
No, Amir was actually one of the highlights.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, the thing is that it sucks when you say to yourself, we have all the role players. All we need to do is find, you know, one more star. And then the team thinks that that one more star is Rudy Gay. And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Well, see, I always take what I call kind of like a 30,000 foot view is that, you know, I like these like year to year progress, the draft picks we make. But end of the day, I'm always thinking, how is this going to actually get us to the end goal of actually contending for a title, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It's so far away is the problem. And I feel like it might be just an indictment of this city as a sports city, is that we've been mediocre for so long, not just for basketball, but in other sports, that the expectations get lowered year after year, that we're conditioned to accept getting an eighth seed as a success without even looking forward to, you know, what's next.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
that, and I know that, you can't relate because you're a Lakers fan.
No, but look, my hockey team, you know, missed the playoffs 5 years in a row, you know, yeah. And then won the Stanley Cup, you know. So it, you know, but I think the thing is when I talk about, you know, may a 45-win season be considered a season from hell, I think it's the same thing. It's going, okay, well, you know, people want to sign Brandon Jennings, and you're going, wait a minute, we have one player under contract next year, Steve Nash, who could retire before then. And, you know, he's making $9 million of what's probably going to be a slightly over $60 million cap. So, you know, like, it's to know that you have ownership that's fully aware of this, and you can guess what their plan is and then see them actually doing those things that you're guessing. So, you know, that like, okay, I trust what they're doing. You know, that's much better than having ownership that just throws money at problems.
Yeah. You know?
And, you know, we share that with our baseball teams right now. If you want to.
Oh,
you know.
Yes.
We could
talk basketball for hours.
Yeah. But
so yeah. I don't follow the NL too much, okay. The National League too much, but I did take a glance at the standings today, and I saw that your Dodgers are in last, just like the Toronto Blue Jays are in last here in the AL East. What's been the biggest problem for the Dodgers?
Oh, it's health. I mean, in more, and that's not saying that they'd be the best team in baseball if they were healthy. But, you know, what's definitely, you know, hurt them this year is they started the season with 8 starting pitchers and somehow got down to 4 starting pitchers. They traded one away, and then 2 got hurt, and one of those 2 who got hurt is out for the year with Tommy John surgery, which he could have had at the end of last season but decided to rehab instead of get surgery. And then the other one is on the DL because he broke his collarbone in a fight.
Yeah, this is the Zach Greinke, the Matt Kemp, Carlos Quinton.
Yeah. So, you know, so that part of it is injury, like bad luck, and part of it is stupidity, you know, bleeding with your shoulder against a bull like Carlos Quinton. And then the thing is that it's almost as if, you know, like I've been in fantasy auction league, baseball auction leagues, where like you have the new owner who comes to the table and he's never had to auction, you know, he's never been in an auction before. So you give him the $260 or whatever budget. And the first thing he does is he blows, you know, 50 of it on somebody that's like a one tool guy.
Yeah. This is the Dodgers.
Yeah, I think what the Dodgers didn't realize was that, you know, some of these guys who have big names, I think the Dodgers looked at it like, we need the United Colors of Benetton. Like, so they were like, all right, Adrian Gonzalez is available. Well, we've got Mexicans in LA. We could use him. He's great. And not realizing that, you know, he hasn't been the home run hitter that he was for, you know, for 3 years.
Yeah.
And then they were like, oh, wait a minute, Carl Crawford's available? Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but we have a lot of blacks in Los Angeles, too. So let's get him. We got to get him. And then they were like, well, we can give you Josh Beckett. And they were like, well, does he have 3 years left on his contract? Like, you mean we could get World Series hero Josh Beckett for 2 more years after this one? Like, and we can, like, and all you want is our, like, number four pitching prospect? Yeah, throw him in. So, like, they didn't realize that, like, Josh Beckett, Carl Crawford, and Adrian Gonzalez of 2000 and, you know, at the time, 12, aren't those three guys from 2008 or 2009. So I'm not going to say they're stuck paying guys because the amount of money that they're willing to spend, you know, doesn't quantify as being stuck. And even Hanley Ramirez, who was great, you know, when he played last year and great in the 6 seconds he played this season, you know, he's, you know, showed flashes of being the old Hanley. But I don't think that they looked at these guys' numbers before, just like, you know, and then like they made a Shane Victorino trade and a Joe Blanton trade last year. It wasn't like they were giving up huge prospects so much as just taking on payroll. But it was like, are you guys even think, like, looking at who you're going after? And then they went after Brandon League, and it was like, just stop. Mm-hmm. Like, you're better off being terrible for a year than, you know, than putting Band-Aids on headaches. And that's essentially what they did. And then in the offseason, it was like they bid, like I don't know, like $10 million more on Ryu, the Korean pitcher, than any other team did. And I love watching a pitch, and, you know, I'd love it if he was their fifth starter and not their second starter right now.
Yeah.
But it's just like, you look at these guys and how many years they have left on their deals, and you wonder, like, and then they gave Andre, the first thing they did when they took over as owners was they gave him this huge deal.
Yeah, they didn't have to re-sign him, right?
No.
They just handed it to him.
Yeah, and a guy who's like 210 career hitter against lefties, you know, who leads the league, I think, and hits with the bases empty with two outs, down by five. that seems to be his calling, you know.
So it's give me an idea of, like, how is the team structured that they have this much money coming in, and is it going to be – is it just an unlimited cash flow coming in where they really don't have to worry about payroll for like the next 10 years?
Well, it's, you know, it's TV money, because you could talk about the Lakers' huge Time Warner TV deal, but the Dodgers' huge Time Warner TV deal is for twice as many games. Okay. So now what you're looking at is, I think LA's going to end up with 5 regional sports channels, which is insane.
Yeah.
So you've got, you know, you're going to have 2 Time Warners. There's still 2 Fox Sportses, and then I feel like I'm leaving one out. But I don't think any games are going to be on local television anymore, unless you're watching a Saturday or Sunday ABC game. You know, you're only going to be able to watch these teams on – and it was inevitable that it was going to go that way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what the Dodgers did was they essentially sold their commercial rights, like the rights to selling commercials during their broadcast to Time Warner. So I don't – forgot what ultimately – I think it might be something like $8 or $9 billion. The total value of what this deal is. And then there are rumors, but nobody can confirm it, as to whether or not the amount of money that they would have to share amongst the other owners was capped at a certain number instead of being a percentage of the overall number. Mm. And that might be like over the life of the deal. So if, you know, if anybody's confused, it would be like, you know, the Major League Baseball commissioner's office told the new owners, once they bought, like, this was the condition that they would buy the team, would be that if most teams have to, let's say, you know, split 30% of their TV revenue money, the big market teams have to split, let's say, 30% of their TV amongst other teams, they would say to them, no matter what, you don't have to share more than $60 million.
Okay.
So even if that $60 million turns out to be 8% of whatever they're getting, so there's that rumor that nobody's been able to confirm whether or not it's true. So plus they're owned by a hedge fund. So, you know, like, who knows how much money these guys have and at what point they're gonna like prove to be fraudulent or bankrupt or like there's such a cloud of secrecy amongst this group. I mean, look, and that TV money's always gonna be there.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, they just, you know, gave an extension to their GM, who's really done nothing to prove that he deserves it. Logan White, the guy who's responsible for discovering every great young player that they've brought up over the years, the Matt Kemp's and Clayton Kershaw's, is the guy that probably should be the GM, and thank God he's still involved with the organization. But yeah, it's just, I mean, and the thing is this is the worst part about it. I mean, if you're a Dodger fan, if you're a fan of every other team, it's great. Well, except for the Blue Jays, it's the same scenario. This trend of teams signing their best young players before they can ever hit free agency or even mm-hmm. arbitration mm-hmm. means that the Buster Posey's of the world and, you know, and the even the Justin Verlanders and the Felix Hernandez's, all these guys are getting locked up before they even get the chance to hit free agency. Mm-hmm. And then the one guy that I was like, oh, there's no way the Dodgers aren't going to break the bank open for this guy was Robinson Cano, who then goes and signs Jay-Z or signs with Jay-Z.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, is Jay-Z going to, you know, do what's best for his client, or is he going to do what's best to keep him in New York? No, nobody really knows. But, you know, the thing is to have an owner that has money and for them to use that money on taking other teams' shitty contracts instead of signing the best free agents. In this new age of young guys not being able to be available, mm-hmm. it's scary. And the thing is, the Dodgers, like tonight, there's some other stupid promotion going on. Last night they had some, you know, female K-pop singer there. Last week they had Psy at the game. Like,
yeah, I saw Psy and Tommy Lasorda.
Yeah. So it's like nobody, like ultimately nobody cares like who's throwing out the first pitch. Like, so you can try to, you know, distract or and Magic went on Leno last night and criticized the Lakers. Yeah. He criticized Dwight Howard and said, you know, but talking about how he made some mistakes this year. And he said, this is L.A. is the kind of city that expects championships while his team was falling into. And here's the best part about it is that everybody talked about how they're in last place in the NL West. They're in last place in the National League. But luckily, nobody else but me has noticed that. They have the worst record in the National League. You know, and it might not be by the end of tonight, but yeah. Still, you know, it's just – yeah,
I wanted to ask you earlier, actually, about the Magic Johnson and his whole relationship with the Lakers. Do people still take what he says seriously? It seems like he just comes out swinging with the criticism sometimes, and then he'll calm that down with a compliment here and there. But he's very critical of the team.
Yeah, I think he feels like he's got to justify this job. By being, you know, outspoken, and then he feels like the easiest way to earn that reputation as being fair is by criticizing the team that he spent his career playing for.
Do you care what Magic says?
I only care what Magic says when people agree with him. You know, like I hate it when very rarely has he said anything that I agree with, because to me most of it comes off like he's
it's all knee-jerk reactions to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, but I feel like there's probably something deep, dark that happened between Magic and Jim Buss and Jerry Buss that causes Magic to kind of go at Jim without calling him out by name. And I know he has before, talking about Genie, I wish Genie ran the team. But it's almost as if Magic might have wanted, like, this is my theory, that maybe at some point Magic wanted to buy into a greater share of the team, and that would involve more power, and that maybe Dr. Buss, you know, left it up to Jim as to whether or not he would, you know, like Magic would be able to do so. And I think Jim might have said no, and maybe that's why Magic decided to get involved with baseball and divest from, you know, the Lakers, knowing that he was never going to have a bigger stake or a larger say in the organization than he currently had. You know, so I don't know. It just seems like, you know, Magic's never said anything about Jim that's fair. And I think that it's almost like a sibling rivalry where maybe Jim was jealous of the relationship that Magic had with Jerry. But when it came to something like, you know, inheritance, when it came to that kind of stuff, you know, Magic wasn't going to be a part of that with, you know, considering how many kids that Dr. Buss had. So that, you know, this was something that probably, you know, Jim was told was going to be his position at some point a long time ago. And, you know, he knew that he'd never be able to compete with Magic when it came to, you know, the people of Los Angeles. That, you know, he was never going to win that popularity contest.
Yeah, I just always found it a little surprising because it's Magic, it's the Lakers, and a lot of times what he says does feel like it's beyond just kind of the general criticism. It does feel like there's something vicious there underneath, right? Like it's personal. It feels personal sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think he also, yeah, it's a lot of him just feeling like he's got to go over the top just to prove that he's, you know,
he's Magic fair. Johnson.
Yeah, or that he's fair, that he can criticize. Because, like, look, I mean, there were times where he would send out tweets after a victory and be like, your Lakers look good, you know, that people got to watch out. They could beat San Antonio.
Yeah, he does that. He does that. Like, yeah. Once every, like, five times where he'll go after the team.
And then at halftime of game one, he turned to his, you know, colleagues in the studio and apologized and changed his prediction. You know, which, hey, fine, you know, he had every right after that first half, but like, yeah, I mean, I don't think he watched the team other than when they played on a night in which he was in the studio watching them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think he got a good idea as to, because this team had a lot of problems, but I don't think he saw most of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But who knows? You know, I'm so tired of his act. You know, I look. Magic was my hero as a kid. I have a framed Magic jersey in my office. You know, I can separate the guy who played for the team from the guy that's on television now. But I just feel like, and I don't expect him to be, you know, to kiss their ass and applaud every move that they make.
Yeah.
Because that's not his job, and he's supposed to be honest and share his thoughts and opinions. Mm-hmm. But it's just sort of like he tries to compound and make problems worth, you know, he has the power to turn people on Dwight Howard. Mm-hmm. So when you say that I never let my team down by, you know, he tweeted that I've been swept before, but I never let my team down by getting ejected from a.
You posted an article, right?
There was a game where, you know, Nick Van Exel got bumped a referee and was suspended for 7 or 8 games. And after the game, they interviewed Magic, and he's like, man, I'm so disappointed in Nick. You know, these guys got to grow up. They got to mature if they want to be successful in this league. And then 3 days later, Magic got suspended for 3 games, I think, for bumping an official and doing basically the exact same thing, just not as bad as what Van Exel did. Mm-hmm. And the Lakers at the time, this is when Magic came back in 94, 95, and they or 95, 96, and they still had a shot at the 3 seed. They ended up winning the games without him. I think they lost one of them. But to say that you never let your teammates down, and then so I found Scott Howard Cooper's game story from the game in which Magic was suspended from, ejected from and suspended for, and his exact quote is, I feel like I let my teammates down. So it was just funny to me that Magic can say, I never let my teammates down by getting ejected from, as if like that wasn't, not that Dwight's ejection was inevitable. But are we really going to get on Dwight for getting ejected from a game 4 in which the team was down 3-0, missing 3 starters, 6 of their top 9 players, and nobody in the world felt like this team was going to win a game, let alone make a run, come back, and win the series?
Yeah, and Magic just kind of just has to stick his head out there with a real, really like general statement, right? Like the most general statement you could make.
Exactly. So it was just sort of like he felt like, I'm going to just pile on Dwight now and then send out a tweet. And then Chris Paul gets ejected from, you know, the game 6 of the Clippers Grizzlies series, and not a tweet from Magic as to, you know, Chris Paul letting his teammates down by getting ejected. I mean, that game was a 13 or 14 point game, I think, at the time he got ejected. Mm-hmm. But let's be honest, you know, that the Clippers had a better chance of coming back from 14 down with 3 minutes left in that game than the Lakers did of coming back from 3-0 down in the third quarter, you know, with 9 minutes left of game 4 and possibly winning that game or that series. So it's, you know, it's just like you can't have different standards for when getting ejected is letting your teammates down.
Yeah, you know why I did that? Because no one cares about the Clippers, Anga.
Yeah, well, and at the same time, look, this is all on Dwight. You know, it's such a big deal when it comes to, you know, perception, public perception, or benefit of the doubt. You know, there's guys who cheated that in baseball that we don't give nearly as much grief to as we do to Barry Bonds, because Barry Bonds is an asshole. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dwight Howard handled everything he did horribly wrong. So when he does something wrong, we're more likely to pile on it. You know, it's just like when LeBron, you know, had the decision and then he loses a game, or he does something, you know, throwing a headband or whatever he does that we blow out of proportion. We don't do that with the people that we like. We do it with the people who we don't like. So I think with Paul, people like Chris Paul, so they weren't going to do it because it was Dwight. We blow it up and we make a huge deal out of it.
Yeah, well, what happens to Paul is because he's competitive. What happens to Dwight is because he's whining.
Yeah, and 2 minutes before he got ejected from the game, I talked about how Tim Duncan should worry more about his health than trying to get Dwight Howard ejected, because the entire series he was getting under Dwight's skin. And hey, I applaud Tim Duncan for doing it because it worked. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, that gif of Tim Duncan smiling as Dwight, you know, goes to the bench with foul trouble or ejected, that was his entire, you know, MO the entire series. Yeah. So Dwight needs to toughen up in that respect. But, you know, because I thought that Dwight was going to get ejected for just throwing an elbow at Tim Duncan, seeing the way that Duncan was trying to, you know, get under Dwight's skin. But yeah, I mean, he's got to get mentally tougher. I knew that was going to happen. It was inevitable, and it wasn't like he was trying to. It was that he wasn't getting calls, and he was not only not getting calls, but he was getting called for loose ball fouls for retaliating, mm-hmm. which is inexcusable in and of itself. I mean, yeah, I get your frustration, but that's when you have to, you know, pull the referee to the side and say to him, you know, you got to pay attention to this, man. You know, they're holding me, or they're clutching me, and they're forcing me to retaliate and. To separate, but he also needs to learn how to get open because he's horrible at it.
I guarantee he shows up to training camp next year. You're gonna hear he's gonna be focused, best shape of his life. You're gonna get all those stories. I think that whole quote unquote narrative on him is gonna shift next year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some people like Jameel Hill wrote last week that, you know, that people – or no, I'm sorry. Tom Zilla wrote it that people would like, you know, Dwight if he went to Houston. And I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think people would like it if Dwight went to Houston because he'd be leaving the Lakers. Mm-hmm. Because people would love to know – like to see that, you know, somebody actually turned them down. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the people that say that Dwight suck can't be the same people that say he's the missing piece to win a championship in Houston. It you can't suck because he's on the Lakers and then not suck when he goes to another team. If he sucks, he sucks. In terms of the things that they're saying are, you know, what makes him, you know, not the same player anymore. But at the same time, if you are going to try to rehab your image, and, you know, you might as well start with the NBA's largest fan base and take it from there. At least, you know, you can count on that many people to have your back and like you. You know, yeah. Everything he's done has just been totally mismanaged, you know, by his representatives. And I know he's got family members that are really involved in his business, and, you know, that's never a good thing. I mean, just look at Derek and Reggie Rose right now.
Yeah. Well, it's been like a shitty 2 years now for him. But, like, you look at the curves of these stories at all the top superstars, if you consider Dwight as a top superstar, and they always come back up. So it's on the way up. Like, yeah. I think this is rock bottom, and then it's coming back up.
Yeah, I think winning cures all. But I think, you know, if Dwight said to himself, this is a team that everybody seems to love right now, this Houston team, and they seem to be, you know, on the up and up and trendy, and I can join that team and everybody will forget about what I did over the last, you know, two or three seasons. You know, he could do that. Or he can say, you know, this Laker team might not be great for a year, but at least I know that they're going to build around me and they're going to have plenty of cap space. And this team has never had a tough time, you know, bringing in free agents. And I can make $30 million more and live in Hollywood and, you know, expand my, you know, empire or whatever he thinks he has.
Yeah, you know? I think the $30 million is just – that's the deal breaker. That's why he's going to stay. I don't think there's really much else. Like, I think that alone is reason enough that he's not going to go anywhere.
I agree, because he can always say trade me later and still get that $30 million.
Except for when LeBron teamed up with Wade and Bosch, and especially because now the sign and trade doesn't allow you to get that money.
Yeah,
it's hard for me to think of anyone that left the money on the table.
I don't think that anybody willingly, took that dramatic of a pay cut off the top of my head.
Because remember Darren Williams last year, there was all the talk too that he might go to Dallas, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Same situation. Yeah. You know, but Cuba does a really nice, you know, does this thing where he, can show you that with the no state income taxes, that you're only going to end up making this much less, and then you can opt out after the fourth year, and then you can make your money back on your next contract. So, you know, Cuban does a nice little presentation where he can, you know, he didn't do it with Williams because he wasn't there.
Oh, yeah, Shark Tank.
Yeah. But we, he, you know, but, you know, these guys all figure out, I think he did it with, I don't remember. You know, did they not meet with LeBron in Dallas? Maybe they didn't.
They might have. They might, but yeah. They weren't. I don't think they were one of the finalists, though.
Yeah, well, they didn't have cap space, but they ended up winning the title anyways that year.
Over LeBron.
Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, I think that's what they're going to try to do again with Dwight, is make it seem like he's not going to lose that much money by going to
Houston.
Either Houston or Dallas. I think they're both going to try to make their case for, you know, the no state income tax and how much money they both be, you know, that the difference, that $30 million he'd only be losing a fraction of.
And then, I think a lot of that is BS. Like, not BS in the fact that it's not true, but it's, I don't think it's as enticing to the athletes. I think end of the day, they want the article to be written that they are getting paid the max.
Sure.
It matters to them. I think it matters to them that they got a, whatever it is, 5-year, $120 million deal or whatever versus the 5-year 80 or whatever. I think it matters.
Oh, yeah. It's a total ego thing. I mean, there's a reason why all of a sudden these, you know, we started finding out the details of these contracts. You know, it wasn't something that, you know, the teams were releasing. It was the agents. Yeah. So, and the players won. And now with Twitter, you can see guys commenting, you know, publicly on contracts. You know, you're seeing guys after, you know, somebody signs a deal where somebody will say, you know, release a, you know, will tweet something like, you know, $30 million for that guy or, you know, something like that, because obviously they're paying attention. But, you know, what we don't see, which is kind of nice, is you don't see guys getting mad when their teammates or former teammates go to other teams for more money, you know, because those guys could potentially. You know, I mean, they have the right to come out and say, I thought we had something special going on here, but they don't. They get it, you know, that this is really, you know, it's at its core, it's a business. And, yeah. You know, James Harden, you know, he I'm not going to say he got screwed because he's, you know, making more money. But, you know, the new CBA allowed teams to sign two guys, to give two guys on rookie deals max extensions. And unfortunately for him, he was drafted third of those three guys. Mm-hmm. So they weren't going to be able to afford to give him, you know, that kind of deal, and they had no choice but to trade him. But yeah, they could have waited a year.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen when Dwight re-signs with LA? People are going to talk about how he doesn't care about winning because he took more money to stay in LA than taking less money for a better situation in Houston. You know that's
right.
Coming.
No, you're right. You're right. And somebody, you know, like I figured out who the worst. I mean, and I've had to unfollow these people on Twitter, but like one is Steve Kyler from Hoops World. Who, you know, one of these guys who publicly responds to every tweet question people send to him. Mm-hmm. And he wrote something to the effect of, you know, Dwight's been miserable since he got to LA. And I sent him a tweet and I just said, you know, is that a direct quote? I just want to know before I repeat that, you know, like, are you speculating? Mm-hmm. You know, a guy who lives in Orlando but thinks he knows that Dwight's been miserable. Like, maybe you have this relationship with him where he's said to you, I've been miserable since day one. Yeah. Or are you relying on, you know, a fifth person intermediary that knows somebody's cousin who's friends with the guy who sells him Gatorade, you know, like,
or possibly just a general observation.
Yeah, exactly.
Of his on-court body language.
Yeah, but you know, that works with your narrative prediction of people saying he just signed with Lakers. He was miserable all year, but he just went with the team that offered him the most amount of money. Yeah, no, that's exactly what's going to happen.
People are going to run with that.
And who's not going to? But who wouldn't do that? You know what I mean? Like, you know, who wouldn't take $30 million more than anybody else was offering? So, and then, you know, and then Bill Reeder from Fox Sports, who, like, frankly, I have no idea how this guy has a job. I followed him on Twitter. I didn't really read his articles. But he was the guy who, you know, who wrote that a high-level executive told me that Dwight is the ultimate team cancer. And then the moment the season was over, he was tweeting about Dwight. He was writing articles about Dwight going to Houston as the missing piece. And you know, which is to me, and then if you look at his articles, just the titles of them. It's like, this dude lives in Kansas City, but he's obsessed with the Lakers.
That's funny.
So, like, everything he writes is, you know, like, if you look at just his Dwight articles this year. But, you know, so I wrote to him, you know, I said the same thing. I was sort of like, wait a minute, he's the missing piece in Houston, but I thought you said he was the ultimate team cancer, you know?
Can't like, have it both ways.
Yeah, but I mean, my whole thing is this, is like, don't get, you know, don't share tidbits of a guy because he plays for the Lakers that you wouldn't share if he was playing for another team. Or tell me that stuff about that guy when, you know, if Dwight was the ultimate team cancer in Orlando, how come we didn't find out about it until now? Like, why were you protecting him then, but you're not protecting him now?
Yeah.
And, you know, so, like, yeah, I mean, like, this dude's really the worst. Like, you know, you can read his – just read the titles of his articles on Fox Sports. And it's just like – and I'm sure that there's, you know, editors who are telling their guys to write a lot of articles about the Lakers.
Yeah.
But at the same time – like, and then, you know, Whitlock writing his article about Phil Jackson and Kobe Bryant, you know, and their egos during the playoffs when both were tweeting during games.
Yeah.
It's like, really, man? Like, that's what you chose to write about?
I'm going to send you a photo of my of this outline that I did for this podcast, because Whitlock is actually one of the point form notes that I made. So thanks for that. So any updates? I was going to say, any updates on your issues with Whitlock?
No, I mean, you know, my thing with Whitlock is, you know, him tweeting at Kobe, you know, after his, you know, this lawsuit with it involving his mom trying to sell his possessions.
Yep.
And he wrote, like, keep your head up, bro. So I just wrote to him, I said, oh, so his mom sues him and it's keep your head up, bro. But when his wife files for divorce, you know, Whitlock was the one who sent out tweets, you know, with Vegas odds on which one of Kobe's former teammates was going to be the first one to have sex with her. You know, so one of them is worth sympathy. But when his wife decides to file for divorce, then we're taking action on who she's going to fuck first.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just my whole thing with Whitlock is that, you know, like, I mean, and I wrote just a couple weeks ago on Twitter that with Whitlock and Toure, it's the same thing. It's like these guys, when the conversation starts and something happens in the world, whether it's sports, politics, doesn't matter, these guys are nowhere to be found. And then they enter the conversation 15 minutes late and they're like, oh, I'm here now. So let me tell you, like, this is what really happened. And it's like, come on, don't. It's like Donnie and Fargo. Like,
I think it's a lot of inconsistent, or a better word might be irresponsible use of the platforms that they have, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing with Whitlock is that it just got to the point now where I won't even read the articles. I mean, there was a point where I would read them just so I could, like, criticize them.
You've given up. You're getting better.
I won't let him troll me to that point where, you know, where I'll actually read these articles and then have to, you know, clown him line by line. I think with him, it's more about just, you know, not reading those articles and making fun of his tweets. Just
have you ever tried listening to his podcast?
I listened to two. I listened to the one he had with Brian Windhorst, which I thought was pretty good, and Jackie McMullen. I don't know if that was the same one or a different one.
Yeah.
And then he did one with Bomani Jones that I listened to that I really liked too. But the one that he has, like, with the Custodian and the Isaiah Thomas one, I just he talks so slow.
You should listen to the one with Jen Sturger, just so.
Oh, like, just because it's so bad, it's good?
I wouldn't say as bad as good, but I think that summarizes who Whitlock is. Just the conversation that they had, and just the type of sort of material that he likes to dive into.
Did he get pervy like he does with...
Yeah, you know, his pervy is funny because he just laughs, and then he doesn't say anything. He'll always say, I don't want to get into it.
Yeah.
With a chuckle.
Yeah.
His intro entertains me, though, the podcast intro.
You know, there's a guy in L.A. that a lot of people don't know about named Joe McDonald. People in L.A. know who he is. And Joe was very much like Whitlock, where they've just burned every single bridge. And Joe, ironically, works for Fox Sports, but for FoxSportsWest.com, like for their L.A.-based, you know, website portion. And he has his own podcast. I think it's involved with Jay Moore's network, because I know, you know, Jay Moore used to always be a guest on Joe's show, and they were kind of good friends. And Joe was famous in LA because at one point he weighed close to 800 pounds, and now he's, like, you know, closer to 300. But he's got bleach blonde hair, and he, like, wobbles through Staples Center, so he still has media credentials and gets asked questions because he still has this column for Fox Sports. But Joe is the guy that asked Mitch Kupchak during the exit interviews if he planned to make a run at Chris Paul while the Clipper season was still going on. Even though Lakers don't have cap space to offer to Chris Paul. Yeah. So, like, you know, and so Joe's sort of like Whitlock in that sense, where, like, Joe used to, when ESPN Radio bought their station out here, I think Joe was their first program director, and he would spend like a half an hour during every show just criticizing management to the point where they fired him. And then he ended up on another radio station where he would make fun of another radio station the entire time. So when that one fired him, the one that he made fun of nonstop wasn't about to hire him again. So now he works for like one of the news stations out here doing like sports updates. And then he has this small column that nobody reads. And but it, Whitlock and Joe are a lot in the same way, where they've both become practically irrelevant, except when controversy is involved, like, you know, Jeremy Lin with Whitlock. And then for the most part, like, nobody cares what they have to say. And now they're kind of, you know, fighting for their professional lives because they're both at the last place that'll probably have either of them.
Yeah. Also, but, can you agree with me that Jason Whitlock looks a little like Jarrett Jack?
In the face?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. The guy that everybody used to say Jarrett Jack looked like was 50 Cent. You know, and then,
really?
Yeah, and then, you know, I guess somehow, I guess 50 got, you know, bigger. And,
yeah.
And but, like, you know, when ESPN used to have those lookalike pages, it was always Jarrett Jack in the box side by side with 50 Cent.
There was always Chris Childs and Nas. I never saw that either.
Yeah, I never saw that one.
Yeah.
Now I'm trying to remember the best one. I mean, obviously, the Corver, you know, that was a good one, and Devin Harris and Ludacris. You know, there were some that were a lot better than others, and then there were some were like, that's racist. Like the USC's athletic department tried to put a side by side picture with one of their, I think, football players and Ludacris today, and I was like, man, that's just racist, you know.
Well, like, I just think Jack and Whitlock's their face looks very.
I guess, yeah. Well, they both have, you know, kind of you know, they both look like they're staring in the sun, you know.
Exactly.
But you know, but Whitlock, you know, used to have a TV presence. Now you got to catch him on Jim Rome at, you know, 4 a.m. on Showtime when, you know. But other than that, like, you know, he's fired from the sports reporters, and he doesn't get much of a chance. And I guess he was on some HBO roundtable or something. A little while ago, involving, you know, some anniversary of something momentous. But, you know, he's just like, I just don't understand how he got to where he got. Like, when he had that crazy rant on radio, when he, like, quit his job on the radio, and he was, you know, promoting it on Twitter about people tuning in, it was just like do you think people think of you like, you know,
it seems like he still maintains a good relationship with Simmons, though. Right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I've seen Simmons give him shout outs, like in his columns and stuff like that.
Yeah, and they probably talk, and they might hang out every once in a while. And I think that, you know, I think Bill, you know, I don't think Whitlock's somebody whose bad side you want to be on just because you can avoid it, and who wants to, like, have to answer questions about it. Mm-hmm. But it's funny to me that he constantly retweets his idiot Twitter followers who believe the stupid, you know, fake stuff he sends out. Like, he has this ongoing bit where he played for Michigan and then transferred to Ball State. And there's people who still believe this, so they'll send him tweets like, does your mom still have your Michigan jersey? And he'll retweet it and be like, you know, and he'll comment on it. And it's like, why are you telling us that the only people who, like, respond to you or read your columns are morons?
Yeah.
Because that's all I get out of it.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear that you've quit the columns.
Yeah, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah, but for sure, every time you come on the podcast, I'm going to do a Whitlock update just to hear you rant.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. We've gone over time, but before you go, a couple of stories that you mentioned that you wanted to tell. Maybe start with the Super Bowl story with Aaron Taylor, is it?
Yeah, I have a friend who went to San Diego State, and I won't, you know, mention him by name, but played football at San Diego State. So when the Super Bowl 32 was in San Diego, it was the one where the Packers and the Broncos played. It was one of the best Super Bowls ever. And the Packers rented out a bar. And the Aztec, San Diego State football players, their season was long over, but they were all kind of offered, you know, short-term jobs, whether it was like driving around VIPs or bouncing at, you know, clubs. But the Packers had rented out an entire bar. I think this was two nights before the game, so it wasn't like, you know, they were getting drunk before the Super Bowl. Yeah. But they wanted to, you know, have a little bit of fun, so they invited these guys to come and hang out with them, and then they brought, you know, any girl that they saw was invited to come and hang out with them. So my buddy's in there in the bar with them, and at the time he's like a, you know, college junior, and this girl says, what position do you play? Now he's surrounded by Packers, so he's a big dude, he was offensive lineman. he can't sit there and lie about, you know, playing for the Packers, because they're all around him, and, you know, he would look like an idiot if they caught him in the lie. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I'm offensive lineman. So she never had asked him what position, what team he played for. And then she says, well, what team do you play for? And Aaron Taylor, who played for the Packers at the time, they had won the Super Bowl. You know, they beat the Patriots. He had his Super Bowl ring. So he looked at my buddy, and I'll just say my friend's name was Max, right? He looked at him. He said, Max, you know, if you leave this ring on the table again, I'm going to take it away from you. And my buddy, you know, was like, thanks, man. I'm such an idiot. And took the ring and he put it on his finger. And this girl, like, Aaron Taylor was willing to pretend that my buddy was on the Packers to help my buddy get laid. And it worked. So this woman went home and thinking that she slept with a Super Bowl champion when she was sleeping with a college junior.
The perks of hanging out with these guys.
Yeah, the perks of being like 6'4 and 300 pounds. My daughter just walked into the room.
Give her guest credit. And then the last one is a Shaq story you wanted to tell, right?
Well, the Shaq story is great because it was a bar in LA called Bar One that had 12 different names and was very popular at some point. And I went with some friends there. Teddy, hold on. I went with some friends there, and Shaq walked in, and a friend of mine was, you know, trying to pick up on girls. So he said, you know, Shaq, look, you know, I don't want to autograph from you. I don't want a picture with you. I don't want to, like, ruin your night. But there's a girl that I'm talking to, and if she thought that I was, you know, friends with you, that would definitely help me out. And so Shaq's like, all right, you know, whatever, man. You know, I'll see what I can do. He's like, well, you know, could you just, like, kind of come up to me and, you know, say what's up, you know, just, like. Like, say, what's up, Nick, you know? And Shaq was like, yeah, you know, like, if I get a chance, I'll do it. So the whole time he's talking to this girl, and he's telling her that he's friends with Shaq, and that, you know, she's waiting for Shaq to come over to say hi. And meanwhile, Shaq's, like, not showing any signs at all that he's going to come over and, like, follow through on this plan. So my buddy's kind of getting bummed out. And then it looks like Shaq's, like, gathering his things, and he's about to leave. And he starts walking towards the exit, and he turns around, and he's like, yo, Nick! And he's like, yeah. He's like, call me. And it was, like, as if that was Shaq's plan from the beginning. It was like, I'm not going to, you know, like, I'm not going to spend any time with this guy doing, you know, BS fake small talk.
Yeah.
But on my way out, I'll make sure to give him a shout. So the fact that Shaq didn't forget about it.
Yeah.
It tells you, you know, what kind of guy, but, you know.
That's pretty good.
He was here. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
When I was in San Diego at the time of that. I was staying with my buddy, but I obviously wasn't invited to that particular event. So he told me, you know, that night. But, and then I was at the Shaq one. It's one of the few times I saw Shaq out in public.
Yeah. You didn't get him to sign a napkin this time?
No, that was bad.
You weren't collecting. You're not collecting napkins.
And that wasn't the cell phone age, because that was probably, you know, maybe a few people had cell phones. It was probably like 97, 98. Yeah. I don't think the Lakers had moved into Staples Center yet. But yeah, I think I reached the point where I stopped asking for autographs probably around, you know, 14 years old. So at that point, you have to start buying them if you want them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, listen.
Yeah.
Duranga, always a good time. I'll let you go. Looks like you have other things to tend to.
Yeah.
So come back on next time. I still have a lot of stuff to talk to you
about. Absolutely, man. We'll do it at least once during the summer.
And just to let you know, the recording's good, so I'm not going to ask you tomorrow to do it again.
Nice. But if you did, I would oblige. As long as it didn't interfere with the Kings, the Blues.
Perfect.
Thanks,
man. Thanks again, man. All right, talk soon.
You too.
Yeah.